Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Today on The Grave Talks, exploring the paranormal in Charleston and Savannah. Charleston and Savannah are two of the most haunted cities in America. From the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, earthquakes, fires, and disease, there are a lot of reasons for those cities to stake the claim as most haunted. If you've ever wanted to join a paranormal investigation, Charleston Paranormal and Real Haunted Savannah invite you to join them and experience the paranormal for yourselves. Today on The Grave Talks, we dive into the equipment, the locations, and cursed objects with Chris, Julie, and Sean from Charleston Paranormal and Real Haunted Savannah. This is interesting. So we've got Chris, Julie, and Sean on with me today, and we're going to talk about Charleston Paranormal and Real Haunted Savannah. And those two are connected. It's the same company, correct?
They're separate companies, but we offer the same services, and they share like an online store, or some other things like that, where, you know, they merchandise, and you can basically, you can look for tours in either place.
And I Googled, it's only 108 miles from one to the other, Savannah to Charleston, something like that.
It's really 100 close. Miles away.
Because so, in my brain, because I live in the middle of the U.S., in my brain, they're probably like 200 or 300 miles away. So I was surprised how close you are.
About a two-hour drive. Mm-hmm.
So today we have Chris Olson with us today. And Chris, tell me a little about what you do with the group.
You know, we basically, you know, the life cycle of, you know, what we would do on a weekly basis is, you know, we would have new guests booking paranormal experiences. We would organize our gear and have that ready for that night, meet the guests, give them kind of a basic 101 introduction into paranormal. So all groups are different. So sometimes we have folks that come here and they've already investigated other places. They have their own equipment. Other times the folks are brand new. And they come from all over the country. We've actually had people come from all over the world to do the tour. And, you know, the groups vary depending on what someone's interested in doing. We've got kind of a basic walking group that we do in downtown Savannah that has investigation. We have several houses and other haunted locations, like the diner and the speakeasy, the farmhouse and the Deweese house that we'll do, you know, 3 to 4 hour investigations at. And then we have some overnight locations that we'll book out and do an investigation and they can spend the night. So it's really, it's just about, you know, your level of how comfortable you are with paranormal is and how excited you are to do this is going to determine which one you pick.
And Julie, what do you do with the group? Just kind of the same?
We have a walking tour in downtown Savannah that we take you to several different haunted locations and explain the history of the location, the house, the mansion, the cemetery, and the specific ghost story associated with that place and what drew us to investigate it. And then we share the evidence that we captured on our investigations and see if it matches up with the ghost history. And I go into a lot of that on that specific tour.
Now, Sean, you have an entirely different role here. So you're working on a documentary.
That's correct. I'm working on a documentary that two different documentaries, one on haunted items that specifically Chris and Jules have in their home. And then another one that's focused on a location where we actually do an investigation and have a full experience, which, you know, was an actual experience. I think we had a few different forms of encounters. So great to be working on that. And so, yeah, I'm more of an outsider who's been looking in at it from a different perspective.
It's kind of interesting, I bet, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I should mention, because Chris and Julie, you two are married, right? So that's why the haunted items are in your home. So in
they
case
are
somebody's
right
like
behind us in this glowing blue cabinet.
Yeah, that's where they live.
That I want to dive into the haunted items here in just a minute, because that's really interesting to me. But Chris, I'm going to start with you. Do you have a history, a background somewhere in your life that led you to this sort of field?
No, I actually have a completely different background. I feel like, this kind of picked me and it completely changed the arc of my life and where it was going. I was renovating a house in Charleston that belonged to a friend of ours and doing demolition, insulation, drywall, mud, paint, just, you know, bringing it back. It needed it. And within a day or so of being in the house, it was clear that things were going on in the house. I actually ended up seeing like two different spirits in 2 days, or thought I did. And so I came in the next day with a video camera and an audio recorder, because I played music. So I actually had a Tascam digital recorder. So I brought that in and started to record sessions of just talking out loud and filming myself. And then I'd go back through and listen, and there were voices answering that were not in the house. It was just me and one other worker. And at the time I recorded these, it was just me in the back rooms, just by myself. And so after I heard other voices coming through on the recordings, I started to buy other pieces of equipment. We purchased a spirit box, one of the first, the SB7. And then from there, I just kept buying more equipment and then getting more and more responses from the house. And I was in the house for 5 weeks doing the work. And it got to the point where, you know, we'd show up in the morning and knock on the door, have the spirit box rolling and say, "Hey, good morning." And they're like, "Morning, morning, morning." Like they're like waiting for us to walk in the door. We would play music and do demolition or do whatever we were doing and then take a break and talk with them. And, you know, we did sessions from, you know, at 8 a.m, 10 a.m, 2 p.m, really throughout the day. And they were busy and talking. And we've done that house now probably 200 times. I mean, it's just a lot of times. So we have captures in the house, you know, with the same spirit saying the same thing, the same kind of way, year after year after year. And so it's really become kind of an archive to be able to go back and say, like, you know, here are all the people in this house.
That's interesting.
And, yeah.
Julie, how did you get started in this?
Really, I always had a belief in the afterlife. But I wasn't sure about ghosts. And since I was 22, I've always lived in historic houses in downtown Charleston. And one in particular I renovated. And there was something off-putting about the attic bedrooms and I would have nightmares about going up there. And so I went to the library and I did the research on the house, and it turned out that a little boy died in a fire in the attic. And also the attic was used as slave quarters. So that's where they slept. And that was their private area, if you will. So just the history and the feeling that those people must have had, you know, being enslaved, I think it just had this heavy feeling. But I didn't ever see anything or hear anything. It just was an emotional feeling to me. And then when Chris went into this house he was talking about and started recording things, and I listened to the recordings, I was just blown away. I'm like, oh my God, they're talking to you. So I went over to the house with him and we put the spirit box on, and they were just talking. And when he came home with the recording, not only did we have spirit box, and it was just regular clean voices coming through on the audio that didn't belong to me or Chris.
So yeah, I see why you got interested then.
Yeah.
And Sean, you have kind of a different background, I'm going to guess, because you're doing a documentary. There's two, Haunted Objects, Haunted Savannah, as you mentioned. But how did you decide you wanted to do this?
We had gotten in contact with Chris through, I think, my dad, via an old Discovery show that my dad had been on or something like that. And we started to talk to Chris and just became fascinated with his approach and what they were doing as a successful tour and collecting the information, collecting the, you know, the evidence, and felt like it was, you know, something that was worthwhile. And I'm also have in the last couple of years moved to Georgia. So the fact that they were in Savannah, you know, made it more of a regional thing. My most recent documentary is called Georgia, Bigfoot in Georgia. So I'm trying to stick to things that are very specific to the region. That's where it got started for me. It's very, I think it's fascinating. And also the approach and how many people have discovered, you know, more about it and experiencing it and how they're introducing it in a very positive way was very attractive to me.
So Sean, can I ask you a totally unrelated mm-hmm. to this topic side note?
Yes.
So because you mentioned Bigfoot in Georgia, and this is not mm-hmm. a show about that today, and I've done episodes on that. What do you think? Yes or no? Do you think there's something out there or...
If there's something out there, which I think that there's probably a good chance that there has to be something that is pretty this, are they elusive.
Isn't that true? It's like people totally believe it, but you know, there's a couple pictures. I mean, especially Bigfoot, we've all seen that photo, mm-hmm. but you know, it seems like there would be a lot of evidence.
There would seem like there'd be more. I think there's more evidence of an afterlife in many ways and more ways of collecting that than we've done on Bigfoot.
Okay.
By far. So like if you'd have to ask me to pick one over the other, that it much me more the presence of an afterlife than the presence of Bigfoot at this point.
Every state has one. And so it just seems like, I don't know. Seems like there would be more evidence. But the people who believe totally believe, and I'm not here to judge.
It could be just the afterlife playing with us.
Could be, right? I do want to ask Chris and Julie, when you go into an investigation, you know, maybe it's a new location or maybe it's a place you've been a lot. Do you have a certain approach to it? Do you kind of introduce yourselves or even a, hey, we're back, here's what we're doing today? Because I do talk to a lot of people who have that conversation and explain it to the spirits who are there so they kind of know what you're doing and why you're there. And I see you nodding your head, so yes.
That's exactly what we do. Yeah. If it's a new place, we introduce ourselves and mm-hmm. we ask them if it's okay that we're there. Mm-hmm. So we try to ask for permission. Mm-hmm. If it's a place we've done a bunch, we always say, hi, it's Chris and Julie. We usually have guests. So we say we've brought guests to meet you. They're going to introduce themselves. And I think it's just a polite way to be because they're beings and you're going into their space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I think that.
Yeah. And
go
just
ahead.
To add to that, you know, you mentioned getting permission and it's really important whenever you do this. You know, I know there's a lot of people out there that just like, man, I'm going to go break into the sanitarium tonight, you know, and you know, it's really important to have permission when you do this, not just from the owners or legally, you know, having permission to be there. But it's also important to get permission from the spirits that are there. And it's actually one of the things that we require of ourselves before we bring people anywhere. So like if we go to a new place, any place that we do now, we've had that conversation and gotten a spirit box response that says, you're good to be here. And so we won't bring people into a place at all if we haven't got that affirmative from them. And obviously the, you know, the owners, in some cases, you know, that's us, in other cases it's not. And so we have to make sure we always have permission before we investigate from all parties.
Have you ever gone into a location and had that conversation and they're like, absolutely not, don't want you here tonight?
The church at the top of Harper's Ferry.
Oh, that wasn't even, that was a bad place. That was, I didn't even want to be there anymore. That place is, so another warning. The church on the top of Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, that was blown out.
So it's open. You can walk through the structure. It doesn't have a roof anymore. Oh, okay.
Not a good place. Not a good place.
It people just had a negative energy that, and we captured some things.
Really bad stuff.
In the recording.
Yeah.
And so we left.
People did bad things in that. So churches in general, right, when they're abandoned, you know, they get targeted by certain groups that do bad things. And that church is an example of a place where people have absolutely gone there and done bad things. And to the point where when I would face the church with our equipment, and you can actually, here's one of our rigs right here, you know, that we build. So when I'm facing the church, you know, I'm getting all kinds of crazy audio feedback. The voices that we captured inside that church were very negative. And like, you could tell by the vocal tone, like their intent, you know, it's really obvious when something is not good, at least to me. You know, you hear it too, when we listen to things, every now and then we'll listen to something like, who is that? You know, like, who is that guy? And we've run into some negative spirits throughout, you know, like there's quite a few down in Factor's Walk, which is, again, a public space. So as far as permission goes, it's a public space, right? If you rent a room in a B&B, you own that room for the night. That's your contract. You have permission in that room to do whatever you want. So like there's certain things where I feel like you have granted permission to investigate, but we also would not want to go back to some place that had negativity in it. Because you're just asking for something to pick up on you.
And we even had a recent investigation. We had a guest who also is a professional ghost hunter from Virginia. And they came down to see us in Charleston. And he was literally made to feel sick to his stomach and got pushed out of the house, and he could not go back in and finish the investigation.
I'm not sure exactly why, but I feel like he went looking for that in the house.
Maybe.
Like, so there's one room in the back of one of the houses that we do on a regular basis that has someone who I would describe as like a grumpy person. Like they don't want you in the room, and they're like an aunt or an uncle or something. Like they're kind of in charge, you know, in their area. And these guys were just like all about spending all the time in that room. And I feel like that person, the spirit, was kind of like, all right, I'm done with this now.
Yeah.
Where when we do that house, typically we end up spending time in the front dining room next with to the fireplace and the green room and maybe the front room or maybe outside. But we don't tend to spend a lot of time in that back room. And even when we go back in there and set up a camera, I'm like, I'm extra cautious when I talk with that person. And I'm like, hey, you know, we have a group here tonight. They may come in or out.
Now, when you guys go to investigate, people can join you, right? So I could sign up to join you someplace. And I don't have to be an experienced investigator, but I could be. So as you're talking about this, it just makes me think someone who's thinking about getting into this, really a smart thing to do would be to join a couple like you two, go investigate with you, see how you're doing and get some tips. I think people go into this thinking, yeah, I can just go sit in that back room and talk to that guy. And I just think they're opening themselves up for some things they might not be able to handle. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that it's important to have a guide, you know, especially when you're just starting out. And that's kind of what we call ourselves, you know, in the group. You know, and we have other guides, you know, that friends and actually one of our first customers ended up being a friend and then a guide. And she helps us out with our Charleston locations from time to time. But having somebody there who has knowledge of the place and known captures, even things like tips and tricks, like how to get the best evidence. Like, let's get past the, okay, here's where I'm going, here's what I'm expecting to do. But even down to things like, if you want to get the best evidence, here's what you need. You know, here are some things you can do to make that happen. Noise control, you know, having noise discipline is important. You know, if you have a group and everybody's having fun is good, but if everyone's just like talking over, you know, all mm-hmm. the time, you're not going to capture the voices, or you're not going to be able to clearly identify it. Even if you can hear it, you're not going to be able to prove that it wasn't anybody else because it's just mixed in with all the other voices. So you got 6 to 8 people. When you get 6 to 8 people in a house, you can, you know, do different activities. You can split up. You can send 2 upstairs and 2 in the basement and have 2 on the main floor. And there is still, you know, some integrity with the audio in those spaces because they're far enough away, or, you know, 2 in the back, 2 in the front, or you can have everyone together. So it's really each group, once it starts, it just unfolds into a totally different night. Even if it's a place that we've done 100 times, every night is different because the group's different.
What kind of equipment is your, like, your go-to piece of equipment? Like, what are the, what do you use that, what you get the most evidence from?
You know, I'm holding one of my custom rigs that has infrared light, a fully modified camera that can see in all light spectrums. So infrared and ultraviolet, ultra high def recorder, the ability to charge so it can run for, you know, really,
oh, yeah,
it can trickle charge for the entire night.
And you designed that yourself? Because that's impressive.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And it's on a tripod.
Yeah, we actually started building these because what we wanted wasn't available to buy. Mm-hmm. I got tired of changing batteries in the dark. There's another part of this too. When your equipment is good, you're not wasting time or energy or focus on fixing your equipment. You're paying attention to what you're doing, and you're actually capturing better evidence because you don't have to worry. You're not stuck changing a battery while something's going on. You know, you're filming what's happening, and you almost forget that you have this going. That's one of our pieces of equipment, but we have several of these that we've built over the years with different purposes. And we'll use other technology too that's existing. Like, this is our thermal camera. This camera is also being charged. This is a FLIR C5. We've got it rigged up where it'll capture video. So we basically turned an $800 thermal camera into like a $4,000 thermal camera because it can record video with a camera.
And you're good at putting stuff together.
That's like
incredible.
And then this is our mobile rig. So this actually usually has a light on it. And then, you know, we've just got a 4K phone, like a Samsung. And then we've got a spirit box with a Bluetooth speaker. So this becomes, you know, another piece of equipment that will record in 4K. You can see in dark situations, and you have a spirit box right on the top. So you're able to carry really 4 pieces of equipment, you know, with one hand. And you can also, you know, dual wield it. And
listening right now that are like, I want this. That's amazing.
You know, one of the neatest sales I think that we got, we had a couple that came here from, it was Seattle. Washington. Yeah, Washington State. And they were, it was Mike and Sue, actually, and they were 69 and 70. and it was Sue's birthday, and Mike brought her to do an investigation for her 69th birthday.
I love that so
and
much.
Then about a month later, he sent me an email and he said, hey, I'd like to get a couple of those rigs for Christmas. So we actually, the first...
Because they were headed to Gettysburg.
For their, to meet their son, he lived in Gettysburg. So the first set of gear that we ever sold was for a Christmas present. And I was so happy just to build them out, like, and, you know, pack it up. And like, I don't know, it's just really cool that somebody... Sometimes you get humbled by things like we have a 16-year-old girl that chose to do this instead of going to Universal Studios.
Yeah.
And we had a guy the other night at the Dewey's house. It was his 57th birthday. And this is what he was like, this is my birthday present. And I'm like,
yeah, it's awesome.
And I love it.
What do you guys think? And Sean, jump in here too, because a couple places I really would love to travel is Charleston and Savannah. And I never have yet. And I will. What do you think makes them so haunted? Because both cities are very haunted. I mean, kind of to the point where if people think of Savannah or Charleston, it's almost like hauntings. You know, they're just known for that. Is it, and I mean, they both have such rich yet very dark histories. You know, things, a lot of things happen, you know, between slavery, Civil War, and all of these things.
Revolutionary War,
correct. You know, all of these things.
All kinds of plagues, yellow fever in particular, cholera.
But do you just think it's just that history, just on top of the history, and just all of that connects together?
I think it's the history coupled with the fact that there are burial grounds everywhere that are now parks, squares, and homes and businesses are built on top of them. In both cities, just layers of, I mean, like the first city in Savannah was founded in 1733. There will be people here living here way before 1733, but that was the actual founding of Savannah as a city. The first cemetery is called Colonial Park Cemetery, and it wasn't started until 1750. So what happened to all the people between, even if you just call it 1733 and 1750, they're buried all over the city.
They didn't dig anything up. So Charleston and Savannah both had a lot of events that required immediate, like, burial for large amounts of people. And Savannah in particular, you had the Revolutionary War, you had the War of 1812, you had the Civil War, you had fire, earthquake, disease. I mean, you had major events that said, oh, yeah, we have 1,000 people we have to bury right now. And they didn't have a choice. You know, they didn't have refrigeration, so they had to get rid of them.
Quickly.
Before everyone else got sick or died. They would just bury them a lot of times right near where they fell. And, you know, if you look around downtown, most of the buildings are mid to late 1800s. There's a couple that are older. There's only a couple of wooden structures from the 1700s. There's really not a lot of those left. The oldest house in Savannah, and the oldest house in Georgia is actually in Savannah, and it's part of the Pirate House. It like absorbed the Herb House. But other than those two buildings, it's really a lot of like later construction. So there's a huge gap in architecture because of fire. That was a major, an earthquake, and you know, hurricanes. I mean, they had all these different things that could show up, and then you had war on top of it. And so when they were building out the city, they're building out these, all these famous squares that, you know, that they're known for. Those all came in the 1800s, like the, you know, the middle 1800s. All the buildings that used to be there, or the cemeteries that used to be there, they just went right over it. So a lot of those people are still right there. They're under
the ground. And they didn't even know where they were buried in a lot of cases. Because these people, there were the records, and some of them could have been lost over the years where people were buried and things, but they just didn't keep track like we keep track now.
No. The records in both Savannah and Charleston are decent until you hit about 1890. Prior to 1890, it's really hard to find records on structures. And we have a friend that moved to Savannah in July and bought a bed and breakfast. And like, he just is having a hard time researching what was at his house prior to what is there now.
And it's the same in both cities. I mean, you get to a certain point and it just, they start out just listing them as January 1st, 1900. And a lot of those records burned, you know, that's part of
it. Yeah. There was no hard drive backups in the day, you know, there was no cloud.
No. And a lot of times they used to put the deed in the banister at the foot of the stairs. And the top of the banister was called the
mortgage button.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you'd that's pull interesting. It up
and reach down, and your deed was actually right there. Well, if there was a fire,
there goes the
and
deed.
You didn't get that,
yep.
Then you didn't have any proof that you owned the house.
And Sean, what got you interested then in doing a documentary there in Savannah about haunted Savannah? You could have picked a number of different topics.
Because Savannah is clearly haunted.
Because it's so haunted.
It clearly is. And even compared to any other parts of Georgia, it just Savannah just stands out on its own. It's like a beacon for stories and for storytelling on many different levels. And so any opportunity to do anything, to be honest, but to get down into the roots and learn more about the history. More, I love history. And having to get deeper into the structure, the building, the people. It's just another way to tell a story. And so they're really telling stories that we need to hear on a daily basis. And so that's really, I just want to help highlight that storytelling and that connective tissue that and the positivity of it all.
Had you done anything with paranormal investigations prior to doing this?
Personally, no. My partner that I work with, Jason Horton, has edited a few, so he had some knowledge of it. So we know that as a unit, you know, there's a couple of producers we work with that's something that we do that we like to. There's a lot of good opportunities for storytelling for adventure, and, you know, everyone has a different approach. So it's not just, there's not just one ghost story.
Right. Do you go with them on some investigations? And if so, have there been any encounters that you were like, well, I was not quite ready for that?
Yeah, when we did go on our investigation, there was specifically, we were in a back room, like a hotel room almost, but like a suite, I guess, that was maintained by the owner of the club, or suites that were maintained for visitors on the upper level. It felt like that one specific room didn't want me in the room at all. And I can still feel like where they, and there were weird, oddly chairs stacked up, and I can still kind of feel on my hips in the two places where I can be pretty nimble. I mean, I bump into things, but I'm usually pretty nimble, but I really felt like I was slamming into these tables and being pushed away from this doorway in a manner that was, and then there was also an existence of light that we couldn't explain. That we tested through different ways. So that definitely seemed to have some real effect to me personally, because, you know, being shooting it in that way as well, and, you know, and experiencing it all together was definitely something that leads me to believe that there's something more there.
Would you consider yourself a skeptic?
I think being, you know, the son of a journalist and having worked in entertainment news, there is some level of, you know, maintaining bias and wanting to see some evidence. You know, I tell stories for a living, you know, so Bigfoot, to me, it's almost more interesting if we don't find Bigfoot. I think that would become very boring if we did. And right now, I don't know if we'd notice. And when it comes to ghosts, we have plenty of evidence, but it's all out there for your own interpretation. And I think that it really comes to talking about your spirituality and your connection to the earth and your approach and all those different things. So I think it really can be self-discovery in many ways about what you think about who you are, your existence in the universe and your faith or moral code or whatever those things are. It questions all of those things.
You're doing two separate documentaries, correct? The one is about Savannah. The other one's on the haunted items. How did you decide to do the haunted items one? Was that something that between Julie and Chris, because they have some haunted items, is like, hey, check these out, and that was a great idea to go with, or was there one thing that really got you thinking about that?
It was, well, I think that there's a lot of misconception about haunted items, and because the fact that they do maintain a home with haunted items, and we've had so many successful movies that have been about haunted items, I think that it was a kind of a natural, you know, unfortunately on the podcast, you can't see it, but, you know, in the background, there's this incredible case where they keep them and have a deep respect for and how they maintain them. And so I thought it was a very, you know, ideal, especially considering the fact that they spend a lot of time. They spend their, you know, it's their night and their day one way or another. They're kind of spending it in the company of spirits, ghosts, and, you know, anything else that you can mention.
And the case is
talking,
really cool.
Talking books.
It's kind of like lit with a blue light. It looks really cool in the background.
It definitely does, and it'll feature heavily in the documentary, so you'll get to see it even more lit up on some level.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Chris, Julie, and Sean with Charleston Paranormal and Real Haunted Savannah. Get more information about joining them on an investigation at charlestonparanormal.com and realhauntedsavannah.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archives and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it for 3 days free. You can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and find everything there, also ad-free. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.